One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I'm dropping a bonus show for you this weekend. This is one I think many of you won't have heard. It's 5 years old, so the podcast at the time had only been going a couple of months, but it's very, very relevant, and I'm dropping it this weekend for a reason. It's from Gary Voorhees, Kevin Day, and PJ Hughes, and those were three witnesses to the Tic Tac event from the Nimitz Princeton, November 2004, now very famous incident. We talked about the West Coast entity that tracked the Tic Tacs at the time. We talked, was this US testing new technology? We talked about the incident changing the conversation, the nuclear aspect to things. And given the big conversation right now is really about Ross Coulthart coming out discussing the Tic Tacs being Lockheed Martin technology, Representative Eric Burleson saying he's seen similar. We've also heard, though, Jesse Michaels mention that he has heard from David Fravor, Commander Dave Fravor, who was a pilot involved in the incident with the Tic Tac, who is saying categorically, this cannot be our technology. I think it's a great time to go back and revisit what's a very early iteration of the show. I've cleaned up the audio a little bit as well, folks. It was a roundtable with three people and myself, but I think you'll get to hear some conversation from the time, things like the UEP task force are mentioned and whatnot, but you're going to hear three different perspectives from folks all involved in the Tic Tac event with different expertise and skills as well. So I'd be really interested. Listen to this over the weekend, bit of a bonus content. Part two of the breakdown is out. If you're not signed up to the paid feeds, you'll hear that on Monday. But in the meantime, yeah, I think it's a really good time to check out some of the old Tic Tac stuff, and I'd be really intrigued to hear your thoughts on this one and maybe how things have aged. And indeed, does listening to Gary, Kevin and PJ change any of your opinion on what's been said over the last couple of weeks? Please get in touch with the show, as always, email or ideally use the contact form on thatufopodcast.com. But anyway, let's head over to the show, folks. Well, who we do have on the show with us today, we have Gary Voorhees, who you will remember was the first ever guest on That UFO Podcast, which seems a lifetime ago now, but it's just coming up 4 months now. And he is the Vice President of UAPX. We have Kevin Day, who is the President of UAPX, and Patrick Hughes, who is the Director of Information Technology, if I've got that all correct. I'd like to say welcome and good afternoon to all you gents. Gary, first of all, how are you doing?
Good afternoon.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
No, thank all of you for your time as well. So it's great to speak to you. So the format, what we're going to do for the listeners is start off with each of you introducing yourselves and a little bit about the role you played in the now infamous events of November 2004. You might have done some other interesting things that month, but I'm sure the main thing was your activities on the Nimitz carrier group. We're then going to move on to discuss a few different things off the back of that, how things have progressed and changed over the last kind of decade and a half, not to age anyone on here, but it is now getting on 16 years. And then obviously from there, we've got some questions on UAPX and a lot of listener questions that will make up the bulk of the show as well. If we could start off, Gary, yourself, if you want to just introduce yourself, your background and what your kind of role was in the events of 2004.
All right. Well, my name is Gary Voorhees, Jr. I was an Aegis computer technician at the time, a junior personnel. I was the one that actually operated and maintained all the Aegis weapon system, all of the mainframe computers that ran that system, and the consoles that operated in CIC. CIC is Combat Information Center, for those who didn't know. It's when you're looking into movies, all those big screens that they're looking at, we took care of all those. And of course, it's the story has been beaten to a crisp, so we'll just sum it up into we tracked unknown aircraft for right around 7 days back in 2004, and it's now become pretty renowned since the United States government military has basically admitted that what we saw was real.
It certainly was. Thanks for that little summary. PJ, Patrick Hughes, if you want to just introduce yourself, as I've kind of done for you anyway, and tell the listeners a little bit about you.
Sounds good. My name is Patrick, or PJ. I answered just about anything. I was an avionics technician way back when all this happened. And while I wasn't special like Gary or Kevin, my so-called claim to fame, as some people call it, is a couple of U.S. Air Force guys showed up on my ship, knocked on my door with my executive officer, and took a whole bunch of my classified stuff and left.
And I'm going to go ahead and counteract the fact that he says he's not special. It takes... It does take a unique person to be able to that level of technician in the Navy, because there's a lot of education and a lot of schooling, and not everybody makes it through that type of school. So, I mean, we're not talking SEALs here, but we're talking, you know, it's still pretty hardcore to go through a lot of that training.
Yeah, PJ wasn't fixing seagulls, for anyone who's interested in the technology that he was working with.
they were hypersonic seagulls. Hypersonic. I was just informed that on my own feed.
Yeah, my apologies. And lastly, but not least, Kevin, if you want to introduce yourself to the listeners too, please.
Yeah, I'm Kevin Day, 2004. It was actually my last ship on the Princeton. It was actually my last underway, believe it or not, when this happened. When I went down, I had 18 years sea time sitting behind that Spy One radar system on the Aegis. This is my third Aegis ship. I am a Top Gun graduate, went through Top Gun in 1998, and I was an anti-air warfare coordinator on the ship. It was basically just the guy that launches the missiles if we ever had to in a time of war or even for an exercise. And I agree, man, these objects, whatever the hell they were, they acted as if they were alive. Like some super capable blackbird is how I like to describe it. They were sentient and they were aware, and they were apparently precognitive as well, because they seemed to go in directions and ways that just kind of seemed like they were reading the pilot's minds, if you will. It was very, very, very strange encounter, to say the least.
Very, very strange, but obviously now very, very famous. And folks, if you want to hear the detail behind the encounter, there are now numerous documentaries, numerous shows. There are the Nimitz Encounters on YouTube, where you can see Kevin, PJ and Gary all being interviewed. Gary's been interviewed on my own show in the very first episode. The story is now infamous, and obviously Unidentified has been a massive smash hit now. The second season finishes as we're recording this evening, and I've been lucky enough to see the final episode as well, and it certainly does end on a bombshell. It lasts 1 minute and 40 seconds, if anyone else has seen it by now when this gets released. I won't spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it. What I do want to get straight into talking about, though, speaking of bombshells, Patrick, PJ, on Twitter, you recently dropped a bit of a bombshell and you added to the story. And like Gary had said before, this has been beaten to a crisp and this is something that just doesn't seem to go away. However, you added to the story that a West Coast land-based entity, and you know what the wording's like on UFO Twitter, people will jump on the slightest thing, as you find out. You said, so a West Coast land-based entity was tied to your battle group, and if what they saw was released, it would back up what you guys were saying all along. So what is it that you guys have been saying all along, PJ? What are they backing up if they released?
I mean, essentially, all the tracks that Kevin saw, all the maneuvers Kevin saw, all the stuff Gary saw, all the stuff the Hawkeye saw, there was an outside group. And the only person who's figured it out is Gary, although he only partially figured it out.
No,
that saw.
I know exactly what you're talking about. That's just the only non-classified thing I could find about that particular place.
Gary knows.
So listen, the word classified and non-classified is probably going to come up a few times here. What can you talk about then regarding this, just to elaborate on it a bit? Because PJ opened up a bit of a thread on your Twitter feed and people really wanted to know. So what can you talk about dancing around the classified nature of things?
I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff up and down the West Coast from, you know, Upper Washington down to San Diego. All for various reasons, to various stuff, there just happened to be one spot that the Hawkeyes worked with routinely. I'm sure Gary, whether or not he realized it, has dealt with them before. But I happen to know one of the individuals there because they did work with our Hawkeyes. And I've talked to him on and off over the years. And I had recently shared Dave Beatty's documentary with him, just because I knew he was around and he was there. And all of a sudden he's like, hey, I know stuff about this. And he starts telling me. We had a lengthy off the record conversation, so I can't say everything he said. But they saw all the same stuff. Their systems and their sensors were able to track the same stuff that the Spy One did, the same crazy maneuvers that Kevin saw.
I didn't know that.
All of it. I don't know if they have recordings of it. I don't know what was made of it, but they saw it, you know, and they are completely separate from the battle group. So it's not like they were seeing our information. They were seeing anything we were sharing. They were seeing it on their own gear, and they were at a fair distance from where we were.
Okay, so in my mind, and I'm not saying this is what it was, but my knowledge of the West Coast of America is very limited. I just know they have one, okay, and an East Coast. So I'm imagining something like some kind of missile defense building, or let's just say like a NASA office that's just tracking all sorts of things that they might be tracking. And what you're saying is these guys have whatever systems that picked up the same contacts that, you know, Gary picked up, that Kevin picked up, and that eventually kind of had a bit of a play with the carrier group over the course of, you know, a week. Is that right?
Correct.
And
the system that he was talking about, after World War II and us being surprised attacked, that was kind of the system that they went all up and down the coast. I think he's talking about our missile defense system, which then tracks pretty much a fair distance out from all borders and all territories that we control. It would have definitely have picked up the same things that we were. Plus, I'm pretty sure a lot of those systems are now tied into the CEC systems too. So
one thing that did come across in the questions that I'll get to later on was the military language that some of the people have been using. I can only pretend to understand fully the questions that you guys will get to later on as well. But something that was kind of jumped on was that you had to state, PJ, that the entity had no control or association with the object, because one of the things, and I'll address this, I think, to Kevin, given how much you saw and you talked about the way these objects behaved, a lot of people now are starting to wonder, especially with some of the recent journalists and investigative journalists online, are these objects actually man-made? And there are people coming out saying this was potentially Air Force that were covering this up. This has been something that the US government themselves have basically put out there to test its own armed forces against. What would you say to that, given what you experienced?
You know, I have a lot of trouble believing this was us, because I, for one, was psychologically affected by this. As it turns out, I didn't know it at the time, and I have since been diagnosed with PTSD, and they thought it was from an earlier event that happened in my life when, on my first deployment on the Vincennes, when we shot down an Iranian airliner by mistake. But I think it was more related to this. So if it turns out that this was us testing us, and it had this type of effect on some of us, there might be hell to pay. You know, I'm not going to be happy if that's turns out to be the truth. I'll tell you that right now. This profoundly affected my life.
I wouldn't be, honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if it was, you know, something of ours. But then again, in the same respect, what the only thing that really troubles me with it being like ours, it would really mean that they're capable of keeping the type of secrets that we all hope that they can't. Because like the level of technology that was involved with these crafts was, you know, I couldn't even tell you how many years ahead, because it's too many. I don't understand how that kind of technology could be held secret for this long, because it would have, we've been seeing these things for 60 years. So probably more than that. I mean, if you want to talk, you know, ancient aliens, anything like that, I mean, they cite about 1,000,000,001 other references throughout all of our human history where we've been seeing stuff in the sky. So, you know, I don't prescribe to the little green man theory as of yet, because I haven't seen one, but I don't say that, you know, I think that this is not a win-win situation for even our company, because I mean, I've even sat down with our guys, our board of directors, and said, look, you know, we've got serious thoughts about doing this research, because there's some avenues that, and some things that, you know, we really have to think about, because A, no matter what it is, we're going to run into the government at a certain point, because if it is government technology, we're going to run into the government because we're going to have proof of it. If it's not, then we're going to run into the government because we have proof of it. So no matter what, we're running into the government. And so either our government is the most shady pieces of crap that can hide this level of technology for this amount of time, or they're not. And either way, it's scary as hell, because one way we're all not in control. And in the other way, guess what? We're not in control still. So we all just kind of live this beautiful illusion of freedom at this point.
Yeah,
it's kind of scary shit.
It's both very good points. And Kevin, you touch on something that I've had a few chats recently with guests about. And Ryan Sprague has just released a book that touches on the human element of alien or ET experiences and UAP experiences. And like you say, that's huge. And not even to go down the route of, you know, claims that could go in against the US government from, you know, its own armed forces and people and a variety of different areas. But like you say as well, Gary, that if this turns out this is our technology, just as in humankind, then it's such a leap that there are so many more questions of, okay, so where's it came from? Is it back engineered from something else? Have we just one day broken the laws of physics and uncovered all this great new stuff? Why haven't we been using it? You know, it just, there's so many different avenues to go down. However, a show that you're all very aware of, and a group, To the Stars Academy, Chris Mellon, Lou Elizondo, Jim Semivan, Tom DeLong, Hal Putov, and the guys, they very much, even still in this second season where, PJ, you've been a regular contributor, they are very much adamant, and they keep going back to, this isn't Russian, this isn't Chinese, this more than likely isn't ours. They seem very confident with that. So like, PJ, to you, given your experiences with Unidentified, how confident are you, again, having worked with the guys on Unidentified, that this is or isn't US technology?
I mean, the only person I really talked to from that whole group is Lou Elizondo. And we had a much longer conversation than, you know, was actually shown on the series. And we never really got into, is it ours? Is it theirs? He cleared up a whole bunch of questions I had about what happened to my stuff after he took it, where it went, what it was used for. He's the person I like actually learned all that information from. But I got the feeling from him that all he wants to do is know what it is. I don't think he cares one way or the other. He just wants to know what it is, just like the rest of us.
And again, to not spoil it, because I'm more than likely going to release this just before the finale of Unidentified this evening. They wrap up with a very, it's quite a moving summary, and I don't know if any of you have seen the final episode yet. They wrap up with a very moving summary of, they're quite clear on what they think this is without saying it. And again, the line is used, this is not ours, this is not Russian, this is not Chinese. And something Lou Elizondo has said in the past is talking about humankind's and mankind's plural, that it's not just us on this planet. And again, that's something he finishes the series with, and he gets a little bit emotional about it. And again, that comes across the aspect of, if there's more than us on this planet, then it opens up a whole new, you know, a whole new ball game. It changes humanity. And again, those are all questions that are for hypotheses and down the line and a lot of different conversations. What I'd like to ask though for you guys, so To the Stars Academy, it's really been the key in unlocking the door, which so many are now walking through, including people like yourselves that are now following in your footsteps. Do you think there's more to come from this incident itself? So even just the other day, PJ, you've obviously dropped that bombshell on Twitter, and it's added a new element to the conversation. However, is there much more to get out of this, or are we now kind of flogging a dead horse?
No way. We have, our group has been vindicated over and over and over again. I think it's still going to keep happening. Every agency that comes out pretty much backs up everything we've all said. And my gut instinct is that this was not our stuff. And that in itself asks a lot of questions, you know, brings up a lot of real important questions. If it wasn't ours, who the hell's was it? Was it even from Earth, you know? I think this story has legs, and it's just going to keep delivering. I really do.
Well, I know I think our events basically just the straw that broke the camel's back. It's the catalyst. You know, they'll look back and take a look at, you know, how this all started, and it'll be the, you know, that New York Times article about our event, and then all of us coming out, and, you know, and then Fravor coming out and saying his piece, and then the, you know, just recently the pilot that actually recorded the video itself came out to clear a lot of things up too. So I mean, it's just going to keep happening, because there was, you know, I think we had like I think 500 and something people on my ship and 7,000 people on the carrier. That's a lot of people. And that's a lot of people that knew about it. I mean, even if they didn't directly have anything to do with it, or any systems that interacted with it, you know, those communities, they know, we all know. And I mean, it's just like with, you know, with Kevin, Kevin's been definitely affected by this, you know, tremendously. We all have in one way or another. And, you know, for me, it's just been absolutely mind-boggling to know that this is finally coming to light, because I honestly never thought it would. I remember when I first came out about it, I did a lot of phone calls to a lot of important people to make sure that it was all right that I said anything about it, because I really didn't want to knock on the door, you know. And so I got a lot of my old buddies that, you know, they didn't go into cable when they got out. They stayed in the, you know, the circles, and, you know, got the high level government jobs, and, you know, so they let me, you know, I said, all right, you know, I got the least to lose out of everybody, so. let's do it.
God bless you, Gary Voorhees.
you've all played an incredible part in this, and telling those stories and being the first people to do it has been amazing. And like I say, there are now so many more following in your footsteps. So no doubt in the last 3 years, we've seen an incredible amount of progress. And for those that have got a keen interest in ufology, like myself, you know, people who initially just were interested in, are there aliens coming from other planets and spaceships? The conversation in 3 years has changed incredibly. And just the understanding people have as well. There's a lot of indication for people like yourself as well, and military, you know, commercial pilots, police officers, and just the general public that report and see UAPs that, you know what, they're not crazy. Well, not all of them. And that, you know, some of these sightings are as incredible as they sound. If this same incident that happened to you in 2004 was repeated again tomorrow, and we hear that up until, you know, recently, and you guys might even know more recent than me, that these events are still happening, how do you feel the conversation would change from that military perspective? I don't know who wants to come in on that.
I think if I was, you know, an ageist computer technician, or actually they're not, there's no such thing as a computer technician anymore. They call them Q70 techs or whatever they are now. It's been so many years. I think at this point, if it were to happen to me again, and I still had the prior knowledge of the 2004 event, I think I would have a lot more information on hand when I got out. I think I'd have a nice little safety deposit box for when I pass.
I certainly would have kept copies.
Yeah, especially today. You know, yeah, I would have kept better notes, better copies. I had my logbook, of course, but I just had real brief notes like Latin longs and time stuff like that, and who I was controlling. But I would have definitely kept better notes. In fact, when this, in 2009, after I retired, I tried to tell people about this, and even some of my closest associates would look like, you know, what's wrong with Kevin? You know, for sure that happened, right? So I wrote the story, and I published it in the Library of Congress just in case the story ever did come to light, that it would be some sort of contemporaneous proof that it really happened. And that's exactly what happened, strangely enough.
Ironically, with Kevin doing that very thing, it's made me go back and look at a lot of science fiction I've read a little differently. It's like, wait a minute. How did they get these intricate ideas like this?
And on that, it's funny you mention, have any of you read Chains of the Sea? Because this is a short story recently that's kind of came to prominence with Lou Elizondo mentioning or having read it, and a lot of people again have jumped on this bandwagon. Have any of you read that book or short story?
I have not. I've actually been getting knee deep into Philip K. Dick lately.
Say the name of the book again.
It's Chains of the Sea. It's a bit of a short story.
No, I haven't read it. I'm sure I haven't.
Probably worth checking out. It wouldn't take you too long. But again, people are getting on the idea that a lot of the ideas that are now coming to the front, that, you know, we're not alone on the planet. These things may have been here or in different frequencies, different dimensions, that we're starting to see in various different books and prose. Like you mentioned, Gary, some of the things you're now reading, it's like, oh, wow, was this pure chance that people have got this right, or, you know, so accurate so long ago? Or did they have any kind of prior knowledge? So that's something. What I'd like to know, Kevin, if I could just ask a question, on the idea of the military conversation changing, if someone in your position now, today, the same sort of event happened, do you feel they would have a different experience than you had? Do you think they're going to be able to come forward with all the progress that's been made?
I believe so, yeah. I believe there's probably, in fact, procedures in place now that didn't exist when we were serving, designed specifically to deal with unknown aerial phenomenon. You know, because I got to tell you, Andy, the thing that concerned me greatly in 2009, 2008, when I retired, when no one would listen to me, was what would happen if this thing happened off the coast of Iran, when I really did have missiles on the airplanes and on the ships? And somebody freaked out and overreacted. Man, this thing could cause a freaking war, you know, that no one wants. And I think because of that, safety of flight issues, I think there's probably some pretty written and trained procedures in place now that just weren't there when we were serving in 2004. So, and if it did happen, I think it's all going to get recorded and logged and spoken about at this point. I truly do. That's my evidence for that saying 2015. I mean, those guys came out, you know, between, that was 11 years later, you know, so my thoughts on it.
No, that's good. There's been a lot of talk as well recently around the fact the carrier group had a nuclear element to it, was some kind of attraction to these objects. Again, Unidentified had a whole episode, and I'll come to PG on that one because you rolled your eyes. So you must have some kind of comment you want to make, and I've been more than happy to hear it. What are your thoughts on that aspect of it? Is that putting two and two together and getting five?
No, I just don't think the amount of nuclear subs we have, the 11 nuclear carriers we have, you know, I feel we would see a lot more than what we've seen if that were the case. I don't think it has anything to do with nuclear power. And that's coming from a guy who slept next to a reactor for an entire cruise.
And it had no ill effects whatsoever, which is always good to see.
None that I know of.
So listen, what's next? The UAP task force has now been signed off. That's made its way through the Senate in the US, which is great. And I'm learning more and more about US politics, as the whole world is, over the last few years. And we've all got our eyes on things, you know. But staying away from the political side of it and just focusing on the UAP task force, with that forming, Gary, I'll bring this to you. What's your opinions on the UAP task force? What's that going to bring regarding the conversation and the movement?
Realistically, I think it's just a dog and pony show. I don't think it's going to really do much other than maybe distribute more information that they actually want us to know. When it comes down to it, there's over 100 other countries that are starting up a space program. 23 of those countries are slated to go to the moon. With that many countries now starting actual space programs, I think that that's probably more the catalyst of why they're needing to get more of this information out faster. And I mean, there could also be something that we have no idea about. And the idea that there's another race of beings living on our planet with us is not very far-fetched. I mean, we've already figured out there's water deep below. That giant borehole that Russia made, we figured out through that there's literally an ocean underneath the damn crust, which we never knew was there. You know, there literally could be an entire civilization underneath our crust. We've never been there. We don't know what's really actually there. So, I mean, they could have been here the entire times we've been evolving and just, like, you know, patted us on the head. Oh, that's a good monkey. You're doing so good. You know, I mean, but when it comes down to it, people still have to realize that they can't see us as equals. If they were already developed before we even started to even, you know, when we were, you know, beating each other with rocks and eating meat raw because we couldn't start a fire, you know, yeah, there's no way in hell they're going to treat us as equals. So keep that in mind.
And I suppose when you say that, that makes me think a little bit about someone like Tom DeLonge, who I know is a divisive figure still, and he makes a lot of outrageous comments, but he talks about a disturbing aspect to the phenomena. And is that something that, you know, potentially he's getting at? Gary?
Well, I think with him being the owner of that company, you know, and the one view that I have about Lou is, you know, kind of to sum it up is, that he doesn't want to know what it is. He already knows what it is. And because of his ties with his prior jobs, just like all of us, you know, I can't tell you the exact range of Spy 1 Bravo radar, but, you know, I can tell you what we can't do. I can, you know, lead you to the water, but I can't force you to drink it. You know, I mean, we all know for a fact that there's craft that enter our atmosphere that can do Mach 20, 25 plus, that have no wings, that have no discernible engines, that somehow can maneuver on a dime at any angle, speed, or, you know, any vector at all. You know, that in itself should be amazing enough. That should be literally enough to say, yeah, let's get some people on this. You know, wow, you know. And as for as many people that actually have credible backgrounds that have credibility, that have seen these things. Just the empirical evidence alone should have already lent to the scientific community. So that denotes that there has been an active measure of trying to keep this all under wraps. You know, there's no way in hell you can tell me that the empirical evidence that there is out there now is not enough to base any type of science on. I mean, look at some of the whacked out science that they've already done that it's okay because it has nothing to do with something this big.
Can I just go right back to almost one of your first comments you made on this as well? Because at first it sounded almost dismissive, but you've made a really great point off the back of it regarding the UAP task force, that it's a bit going to be potentially, in your view, a bit of a dog and pony show. But then you mentioned that we've got 23 other countries potentially planning on going to the moon. Do you mean the idea that they want to control the narrative, as in the US government or the UAP task force do, because these other countries are going to go into space and then start to see things that we can't guarantee they keep under wraps? Is that what you mean?
What it means is basically these all these countries can't be guaranteed that they're going to say what they want you to say, or what our government wants them to say, or what the collective of governments that can go into space will say. You know, I mean, when it comes down to it, if they don't control the narrative, they got to make sure at least they're controlling the storyline as it goes. So if we already know about it, hey, no big deal that, you know, Estonia decided that they put up a satellite and then saw literally something docked with it or something. And then they said, hey, yeah, so this happened. All of a sudden we don't know what's up anymore. And we're not the ones on top of things. And I think that
is. Andy, this is Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I jumped on you.
No, go on, Kevin.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Hey, Andy, my thoughts on the task force are this, and I'll just make this my public announcement to the members of the task force, Senator Rubio and all those guys. If you guys are serious about finding these things and understanding what it is, then you might want to consider helping to fund our expeditions, because we have a whole bunch of really smart people lined up to go on these ships with a really full lineup of new technologies, and some of them are still under development. And we are ready to go. We need funding. We need a little bit of money. And fortunately, it's not that much money that we need. None of us are getting paid. None of us ever hope to get paid doing this. It's strictly for logistics. All of our funding requirements and any other requirements that we have. It's not to, you know, we're not doing this to pay people.
And Kevin, listen, it's a great timing, because my next question is asking yourself to talk a little on UAPX and its status. Now, UAPX, my last conversation about it was with Gary back in April, late April, early May. And we talked about UAPX starting up, and obviously COVID's been around, and it's here we are 4 months later, and it's still doing the rounds, unfortunately, regardless what people want to think about it. Where are UAPX as a company at, and what are the plans? What's the kind of status of it?
Go ahead, Gary, build that, and I'll fill in some cracks and stuff. All right. If you don't mind.
All right. So primary reason why I'm going to be filling this in is because due to Kevin having a lot of personal things going on with the fire and the you know, their golf course, and you know, he's had to spend a lot of time in his personal life, where I've kind of taken the reins up to take care of the day-to-day stuff. So currently, we did a restructuring since the last time we talked. We've kind of had to streamline it due to budget restraints, versus, you know, what, because like I said, our whole priority is just to go out and do this research off the coast of San Diego. So with that in mind, I had to look at our staff, and we had to look at the people that were involved with the company, and, you know, say, okay, you know, is this person really viable for this mission? And it had nothing to do personally whether they were viable in any other capacity. It was just, I had to look at just our mission. You know, this mission is to do this particular task. We're probably going to have about enough money to get about 15 people out on this boat. And that's so that we can maximize the amount of money for our testing equipment, for budget for things, so that we can actually get the detailed information that we want to out there. And I know last time I spoke about how, you know, we plan on getting ridiculous amounts of information, and we do. And there's a lot of groundwork that has to be laid to get that, because we have to be able to set parameters so that we're not wasting a lot of time on information that's already been gathered by national organizations or other private entities that make their findings public. So we've been utilizing a lot of the time, this go COVID downtime, to do that restructuring. And, you know, currently we're doing a lot of emailing back and forth, and, you know, it's a very pish posh kind of way of trying to get all this stuff done. So right now I'm getting us on board with the Google Suite so that we can utilize a lot of that management, and we can start working on the same projects at the same time, and start to actually get more done without having to, keep waiting for an email to come back or waiting for a response. You know, people can just go in and check on the project, add what they have to add, and then move on. And once we get that done, that's going to be a big mile marker for us, because then that brings our productivity to a ridiculous level. And then I'm hoping by the end of the month to have our website complete with our Patreon and with our with forums, which people will be able to interact with us on a more personal basis. Our Patreons will have access to a Patreon only forum, which then they can actually get one-on-one with practically anybody they want, because all of us will be active on those forums, talking back and forth. You know, it's a way for the public to be able to interact with us and, you know, give us their ideas, comments, and, you know, you never know where the next great idea is going to come from. So, those forums are eventually going to roll into my archives idea that I was trying to roll out a little earlier, but once I had to start doing the day-to-day with UAPX, I kind of had to push that back. But I still plan on doing that aspect of our company too, but, you know, one project at a time. Got a little too ambitious for my own good. Right now we're working on getting grants through particular college. We've written up a grant and a proposal, and I can't really comment on any who, where, what, and, you know, hopefully that goes through. We've already set up a PayPal account so people can start to donate to the cause. Hopefully by the end of the month we'll have some t-shirts that people can buy saying, you know, everything from, you know, just our logo to, you know, I support you know, UAPX type stuff. At first it'll be kind of some simple logos, but we'll eventually have some more trendy stuff on there. It's mostly just to try to get that store up and running, get the infrastructure done, and then we're going to move from there. But I figure within the next 3 months tops, we should have the complete infrastructure of UAPX completely done. Everything up and running smooth like butter. And, from there, basically by the end of this year, I'm kind of hoping that we could basically go anytime we have enough money to actually go. Basically, that's where I want to get us, to the point where basically as soon as we got the money, we're out the door.
And when you look at the UAPX site at the moment, it's got that mission statement on there. And the thing that stands out to me is very much there's a correlation between that, it talks about whale migrations and that mid-November time of year, and you do still hope to see that you can find UAPs in a certain area at that time of year. Is that still the thinking?
Well, after we did a lot of research, from, you know, historical data in that area, looking at, I don't think it really matters what time we go, because there's been sightings year round in that area. It's a literal hotspot. I mean, it's people have seen them in the winter, in the summer, in the fall, every month. I think there's been at least one sighting every day of the year somewhere around that area, in the Catalinas or off the coast or down toward more closer to Baja. But that whole area, every single day, people are seeing things.
So that's been the case for years now.
Yeah. And I mean, we have at least 100 years of historical data for that area that just denotes that. I mean, there's some people that have told me that they could bring you out every day of the week and show you something. Now, granted, what kind of phenomenon they're actually going to come out and show us, you know, I mean, they could be, I have no idea, but we hope that we're going to get some good data. But worst case scenario, we can do a thorough analyzation, you know, analyze this area so thoroughly that we are be able to know the differences between, you know, because this will be the first time that we go out. And this is going to be a lifelong venture. We're going to have to study this area over and over and over again so that we can compare original data to current data to, you know, and keep going on and have a historical data of that area of, you know, temperatures, migrations of animals, what type of plant and fauna, plants and animals that live there, how many of them can affect different frequencies, you know, what kind of radio stations are out there, what kind of people are out there, you know, what kind of all the projects that are done in that area, because there's a lot of government testing that goes out that way. When I say government testing, I'm thinking radar systems, sonar systems, missile control systems, you know, things like that. You know, these are, you know, the benign stuff that none of us are interested in, but they all use frequencies in some way, shape, or form. They all affect that area in some way. And basically we don't want to leave any stone unturned when we look at that area. We want to know how much radiation is, you know, if there's any radiation hotspots of any type of radiation, whether it's, you know, gamma, beta, alpha, you know, I mean, some of these radiations only last for, you know, they're very, very insubstantial by themselves, unless there's a source emitting them at the time. You know, so if we're getting big hot spots of these types of radiations, well, what the hell's causing it? You know, I mean, these are all indications that we're going to be able to hopefully track, find, and, you know, keep doing more research on it. And then the best thing that could happen is we can actually catch them and find them and see them on radar, get the same type of data that we had in the service. That would be absolutely amazing, and that's the ultimate goal, but it's just going to take time. And for
yeah, I get those. Right, so coming back from that message, folks, we had a ton of listener questions sent over. Thank you very much. And I've narrowed it down to about 4 or 5 pages worth of questions. Some of the other stuff has already been answered within the body of the interview, so thank you very much. And folks, some of the names are Twitter names and whatnot. I'm just going to go through and ask the questions as well, because some of you sent really similar questions in too. So if you think it's your question, it probably is. Let's go with that. First question, can the guys discuss the Navy's CEC radar and how it's impossible to misidentify a plane? I think, PG, you want to take that one, don't you?
First of all, CEC is not a radar. It stands for Cooperative Engagement Capability. And the layman unclassified version, it is a real-time data link between a bunch of different ships and airplanes. You know, it doesn't have its own information. It pulls information from all the sensors on other ships and here and there. So it's not something you can spoof. It's the glorious thing about it, and it's available on the internet to look up, is that it takes all the stuff it's connected to and makes one giant picture. So you're unlikely to fool it. But the big thing is the CEC is not a radar. Got anything to add there, Gary?
Yeah, it also has systems on it that are already written into it that if data doesn't correlate with what it thinks it should be, it will not use it. So like, say one of the links was, you know, like one of the links coming from one of the ships was just corrupted. Like, you know, say there was something wrong with the CEC and it was sending a bunch of bad information, it would just drop that link. It doesn't need that link to make the picture. It just needs all of the other links that it has, you know, basically any one link it's not dependent on. So it's collaborating the information amongst everything connected to it. And that's how it's making its picture. So with CEC, it can't be spoofed because it's not something to spoof. It's just it's a data link system. It's not a radar.
Cool. No, thanks for that. So next question. Biggest philosophical question has to be intent. Why, with such superior capabilities, have these craft allowed themselves to be seen?
Well, I think starting with our invention of radar, they'd never intended us to see them. I think it's just as our capabilities become more and more advanced, we're just able to see them. It's kind of like, before we invented AM and FM radio, we couldn't transmit over those frequencies. We didn't even know they existed, So once we are able to, then it just brings us into another realm of existence. So
to expand on that, then why, when Commander Fravor, I'll use the word engaged, that might be wrong, at one of these craft, and as he commented, he came down towards it and it came up towards him. Why didn't this thing just shoot off at that point?
Well, probably for the same reason. If, I got into a fight with a kid, if I got into an actual fist fight with a kid, I wouldn't hurt him. I wouldn't even, I would just do everything I could to avoid them because of how much damage I could do to that child. Why, if they are, actually malevolent, or they're not, if they are non-hostile, that would explain why they don't do anything to us. If it's reverse engineered technology, or if it's our technology and it's our people, that would also explain why they didn't do anything. So, it bodes okay either way, but yeah, it's a question that definitely is staying in the philosophical realm, because I don't think there's a good solid answer for it until we understand and identify the actual objects themselves.
So here's one for PJ. One of the listeners has mentioned that the UAP task force will apparently have more power than ATIP did. But do you think these programs could just get closed out of things like Lou was back in the ATIP days, potentially? Or do you think they're going to be allowed to actually do some digging and make any real progress?
I don't doubt that there's going to be stuff they don't have access to. It's the way the government works. It's the way the military works. I know a secret. You don't need to know the secret that I know, so I'm not going to tell you. I may have a top secret clearance, but that doesn't mean I can know every top secret item in the government. Just because the UAP task force is given a top secret clearance for access to top secret information doesn't mean they're going to get to know everything. Say a cruiser, I'm just going to use the Princeton, sees this again, that UAP task force isn't going to know the Princeton saw the objects again unless somebody tells them, unless there's a reporting process. And the government and military is too big of a bureaucracy to get all that stuff to work the way they really want it to.
Do you agree with that, Gary?
Yeah, the only thing I'd really add to that is the simple fact that, just go to a simple FOIA request. Unless you specifically ask exactly in the right exact words and terminology for what you want from them, they'll give you bullshit back. So unless they know the exact questions to ask, they may never get the right information.
One of the listeners wanted to know, what level of disclosure or admission would it take for these events to make it into school textbooks?
Wow, that's a freaking awesome question. I think UAPX Expedition, when we go out there and we record these things and some really smart people stand up and say, this is what I saw and here's my proof, I don't think there will be any option at that point. It'll have to be acknowledged. That's the whole point of our mission, I think.
You're filing that then under the scientific, side of things, aren't you? That this is science. This is science fact. Here's the data. Here's the experiments we've done. And here's the results off the back of it. So it's irrefutable proof then, yeah?
Yep, exactly. And over to you to tell us what we saw. That's the whole idea. We're going to gather all this data and then give it to some other really smart people to tell us what we just saw. Yeah, and we'll make the school books. So we'll make the history books. And I think that deep down inside, I think that it is going to change it, end up changing the world. I really do.
I think for some of us, it has changed the world, and even for guys like you, it's affected your life. So yeah, I think we're starting to see that kind of the cracks appearing in a really good way. Gary, the next question was for you. How certain are you that the object you saw through the big eyes were the ones being tracked on radar, and did you see any movement?
I'm 100% certain that the objects that I saw were as far as out we were, and that the range and bearing that they were at, it couldn't have been anything else. Timing was perfect. I mean, we're only talking a difference of minutes from the time I go from combat to up to the big eyes. So, I mean, it's not a whole lot of time. So, not unless every single time the same exact object just happened to be there at the same elevation and bearing every single time I went to go look at it, you know. And granted, even half the time we were too far away from them, so to see them half the time. So, when I did get to see them, and you know, anytime they did move, it depends on the angle that we were at versus where they were at and which way, what vector that they went at. So if they were going, you know, parallel with us, I could see them move. But if they were going, you know, toward us, then, you know, other than see them get a little bit brighter or just disappear, that was basically all I could see through the big eyes. It wasn't until I saw the video itself that I really got the good eyeball full of exactly what this thing I've been looking at through the big eyes really looked like. So, you know, it's I'm 100% certain the things I saw through the big eyes were exactly what we were tracking.
It was funny though that the way different people would think about these incidents, because Jeremy McGowan mentioned when I interviewed him that until he spoke to Lou Elizondo about the incident that had happened years before in the middle of the desert in Jordan, he thought it was one object in the sky that was repeating the same cycle. And apparently it wasn't until Luis Elizondo asked him, is there any chance that these were multiple objects just following the same path, that he actually had the idea that, maybe these were multiple contacts that I was seeing. And I mean, it could have been one object repeating, but then again, it could have been more so. But you're quite certain that it was more than likely multiple, yeah?
Yeah, because we were tracking them at the same time. Generally, if it was one object and it was just disappearing and then reappearing because of how fast it was going, and basically we were just getting a hit every, you know, fifth time on them, and that's why it seemed like it was just disappearing, we wouldn't be tracking solid objects across the board, you know, and being able to see the path of these objects. Because you remember when we first started tracking them, they weren't going fast at all. Matter of fact, they were doing the opposite of that. They were only doing 100 knots, which is ridiculously slow for a flying object. So, I mean, that in itself was just odd. So, I mean, they were not going amazingly fast. We were able to track them. They were, you know, luckily for us, very solid objects. Even after we decided that they couldn't be real and then tried to see if there was anything wrong with our systems, there was nothing wrong with our systems. So when we brought them all back up, sure enough, they were all still there. So it was definitely 100% a, you know, real solid multiple objects. You know, there's no way that I think, you know, I have no understanding of anything that would be capable of faking the tracks that we saw at the time in 2004. I know people have brought up other systems, but just looking how the systems work, there's no way they could have spoofed our system.
Even a gigantic flock of really cold seagulls or birds would not
even have... if they were hypersonic seagulls shitting fucking rockets, they wouldn't have gotten through our system.
I'm just starting to believe the hypersonic seagull theory, so let's
I tell
that
you what
alone.
The first time I see a fucking hypersonic seagull, I'd be happy.
Well,
One of the skill sets for operations specialists is exactly what you're asking about, being able to correlate what we see on radar with what the lookouts, in this case, Gary and I, saw visually with our eyeballs. So, you know, one of my skill sets, been doing it for 18 years at the time, and I'm absolutely 110% positive that what I saw on radar
was exactly the object I saw through the big eyes. And when I saw it, it was actually pretty boring, and I was disappointed. Went back down to combat.
I was disappointed, but I was excited I found it.
Yeah, some of the watchstanders actually saw these things maneuver with their eyes. Some of the bridge watchstanders and stuff. Sean Cahill being one of them. Our buddy Sean Cahill.
Yeah, I spoke to Sean Cahill about that back in the second episode.
Yeah, not that I don't love having Patrick here, but I was actually really looking forward to actually doing an interview with him. I've had a couple of conversations with him privately, and other than that, he's a real interesting cat. Definitely somebody I want to get to know even more than I know, because even, you know, him as a, you know, on board being a higher rank and me other being a lower rank, other than running into him from time to time, you don't have a whole lot of personal interaction with people with him. Like me and Kevin, you know, other than, you know, I knew of him. He was a, you know, regular watchstander. So I've had conversations with him prior, but he was a chief. I was a junior enlisted. We were not the same. So it's a whole different animal. You know, we're now, when we speak to each other, it's with mutual respect, but back then it's, you know, you're my junior, you do what I need you to do, and you don't need to know anything else.
That's probably how I feel talking to you guys just now. So yeah. Next question I will throw out to the floor. Was Chad Underwood directed to the Tic Tac by the Princeton radar, or did he find it on Commander Fravor's direction alone?
I think Kevin would have to pick that up. Kevin, what they want to know is, did you guide him into the area, or was he guided in by our flight control, or was he told to go there by Fravor? Like,
Fravor was low on fuel, so he had to return to base with an RTB back on the carrier, and Chad Underwood was getting ready to take off for the next flight. And Fravor's like, "Hey, Chad, don't forget to take an Atflier plane so you can film this thing. Go find them." And reportedly, Underwood replied by saying, "I'm going to go find those things." Jumped in his airplane, took off, and went out there and found them. He came up on Charlie Control, our air intercept control, and we took control of his flight and entered and made sure he went to the right spot in the sky where we found him.
So basically, what they're saying is that Fravor's involvement was to the point of making sure that Chad had the Atflier pod on his aircraft before he launched. And then we were the ones that guided him into that area. And he takes it from there to go look for the objects. We gave him relative bearing and direction, and then he goes and gets the eyes on.
Awesome.
Yeah, so forward-looking infrared radar. Yeah, Atflier forward-looking infrared radar.
Hopefully that breaks it down a little bit better for you.
Yeah, no, thank you. And the next question is along the similar path, but it was actually for Patrick, for PJ. It was asked on Twitter, and I think he said he would talk about it as much as he could when he came on the show. So a lot of debunkers have questioned the capabilities of the FLIR and radar. Can you talk, where possible, on what these systems are actually capable of?
Well, I'm not going to talk about FLIR because I'm not a FLIR guy, but as far as the radar on the Hawkeye, which we tracked, and I'll let Gary speak on Spy. The way the radars work, and there's multiple radars in use. There's a Spy, there's a Hawkeye radar, the fighter radars, the Nimitz radars. All of these radars have different capabilities, different, you know, different ranges, different power, different, you know, processors. They all work differently, and they were all giving us the same information. You know, the way the radar on the Hawkeye particularly worked is it's got inbuilt processing. It was an older radar, but a very modern processor. It's designed to look for that stuff. You know, we used to play games with the Prowlers, which are jamming aircraft, which are meant to jam aircraft, jam radar specifically, and they rarely were able to jam the Hawkeye's radar because the way the radar is designed to work. I can't elaborate on all of them because, you know, a lot of that portion is classified, but it's designed to not get spoofed, you know, and the Hawkeye radar can be spoofed if you're really good and you know what you're doing, but Gary's radar, you're not spoofing. his radar has way too many antennas, way too many. I'll let Gary speak on that, but you're not fooling that radar. You're not fooling this many different radars in use. You know, if it was just one radar, I could understand the whole spoofing line of thought. But when you have this many radars in use, I don't believe it. Gary, you want to speak on SPY?
Yeah. Well, with SPY, I mean, it's not really one radar. You got to remember, each one of those hexagonal panels you see has X amount of feed horns, and each one of those feed horns can be moved in any particular direction that we want, and we can actually track multiple objects with just one panel or all of the panels. All the panels combined together make a 360 degree view. We can do things like burn through, which is where we crank up the power and we just basically focus everything on one spot. And basically, it overpowers another radar, and for effective purposes, jams it. But mostly, it just keeps them from being able to use their radar on us. And then we can also do things like use it as a FCS controller. Basically, we have a different type of radar dish on board called it's a fire control. It's where it's when you hear like on movies where they say, light up the target or paint the target. What they're actually talking about is using RF energy and bouncing it off of a specific target so that we can shoot a missile at it. Now, the missile itself interacts with the target because of how much RF is bouncing off of it. It's the most radiant RF object in the area, so it hits that target. Well, we can do that with SPY. We can do that with multiple objects with SPY. SPY was even then the most powerful radar on the planet. Until somebody develops quantum radars for actual practical use, and not just the prototype that you've seen on the internet. And when you actually dig into it, their prototype is very, very weak. And until quantum radars are in effect, there will be nothing that could spoof a spy radar.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Gary. And thank you, PJ. Kevin, next question was for yourself. And there's a follow-up for Gary, too, on the back of it. And I can ask PJ the same if it's relevant. What was the most amazing thing about the footage you've seen regarding the Tic Tac?
The most amazing thing for me is the fact that it still survived. You know, I was actually down at the golf course. I'd forgotten all about this, even though, because I didn't relate at all what happened to me after I retired and stuff, and I didn't relate it back to this event. As it turns out, that it was the cause of what some of the stuff I was going through, and I just didn't. I mean, how the hell are you going to figure something like that out? I mean, you know what I mean? And I had forgotten all about it. I published my book, went on in life, and forgot about this. I was down at the golf course. I just reopened the kitchen, and I was watching a golf tournament, and all of a sudden CNN's on. Who the hell turned on CNN? And then I saw what was playing. It was that freaking video that I had in my email within hours of this event actually happening. It was the exact same fuzzy video. And I was so freaking shocked. I dropped a plate of fish and chips and yelled out to my brother-in-law in the pro shop, "Hey, Dave, I got to go home. I'll explain later." I took off, went home, got on the internet, and Robert Powell had already posted something. He's from the Scientific Coalition Ufology. I said, "Hey, Robert, this is Kevin Day. We've never met, but you got to call me. I'm the guy that was sitting on the radar when this happened and controlled the intercept." And that's when it all started happening for me. So for me, the most amazing thing about this is the fact that we're even talking about this right now. I never expected this to happen ever in a million years. I really didn't. Gary, you feel the same way? I mean, I'd moved on.
Oh, Gary,
hello.
Well, I hadn't moved on. I never moved on. I've always had my private studies about what we saw. For as much as that's ever going to, you know, get me, but I've always tried to figure out what they are, how they worked, what kind of propulsion that they use, what kind of, you know, how it could be possible for those objects to have done what they could do. These are the questions that have basically made my head hurt for almost 20 years now. So, yeah.
And Gary, your follow-up on that one was, is it possible that what Gary saw in the longer Tic Tac video was a different event to the Chad Underwood film?
From what I understand, no. But then again, I'm also hearing that they've had, that there is a possibility that they have multiple films from multiple planes that were in the air. I think that he may have, I think the rest of the films are all gun footage films from the gun cameras and not from the at FLIR pods. But what I saw was basically, from what I understand, he was the only one with an at FLIR pod. So it would have had to have been his same footage. But there is a possibility. I didn't see like a label. It didn't say Underwood on the screen or anything like that, nor was I really paying attention to that part of the screen. I was pretty much eyes locked on the object that was, you know, the focus of this video. So any of the data that was running along the edges of the screen, which was a lot of data, I wouldn't have remembered exactly what it said. So the only thing I remember is just how numb my brain went seeing this object.
Next question. Again, I'll put out to whoever it's more relevant to answer, but you can all come in, of course. Did the craft seen underwater also head to Catalina Islands? And did any of you see the Tic Tacs enter the water when they reached the islands as well?
I didn't. In fact, when this happened, it wasn't my situational awareness whatsoever. Anything went into the water. I saw this thing drop from 28,000 feet on radar down to 50 feet and just hover there. Now, others have testimony saying these objects went into the water. And I, you know what? That's their testimony. And at some point, maybe some evidence will come out the same as it's coming out now with the different radar systems and other witnesses coming forward. Maybe that same thing will happen with the subsurface contact too. Gary,
I know
you're a lot more interested the meeting with this question, so go for it.
All right, so I know that the pilots reported seeing a very large object underwater and that the Tic Tacs were interacting with that object. So we do have one confirmed report of at least one object being underwater. Direction, bearing, I have no idea which way it went. I know that it wasn't there at a certain point. And then in the unidentified episode where they had my interview, they got me on film saying, you know, they had a track that was over 500 knots under the water, but what they cut off that and so nicely edited was the fact that I literally said prior to that and after the comment that it was told to me by another sailor, which I have yet to be able to get a hold of and verify this for 100%. I've had one of the other sonar technicians that I do know and trust kind of tell me something contradictory, that if there were tracks, it wasn't from the Princeton. I know that for a fact. The Princeton didn't track it underwater in any way, shape, or form. That if there were underwater tracks, it would have had to come from either the sub, the carrier, or some other ship that was in the area. We did not have our sonar buoys out. We didn't have our tail in the water, which means that it's a long sonar buoy tail that we drag so that we can triangulate and track objects through the water. And that's the only way we would have been able to have known what the speed of something was with sonar. So because we didn't have that tail in the water, the Princeton would never have been able to tell you whether it was 500 knots into the water. So if that information was accurate that I received from I'm not going to name the source, but it was, it would have had to have come from one of the other ships in the battle group.
Awesome.
But it's still unconfirmed. So, I mean, that's, take it for what you will. I personally believe it, but I don't, I have zero proof. I'll be dead honest with that. Until I can get the particular person that told me about it to come out about it it is, I have zero proof. So take it with a grain of salt until we have better proof.
No, I appreciate that. Listen, so the next question is one of the longer ones. It was sent over by Jazz Shaw, who many will know from UFO Twitter. I'll read through it, and you might want to take some notes. So some of us have recently been reviewing the original Nimitz Encounter interviews with a specific focus on gaining some perspective on the two individuals who showed up to collect the data bricks after the encounter. PG, I know this is something you've talked on. I asked this question as a former radar tech who served on two carriers out of San Diego back in the day. I was always in CIC, so I don't shy away from the geek talk. And for those I've been speaking to the guys about on the show and the listeners, this is some of the language that I was like, what? So I'm hoping the guys will understand this, and I'm sure they will. In some of those interviews, Gary Voorhees described them as two guys in suits. I'm assuming he meant jumpsuits or whatever uniform or clothes they had on underneath. The interviewer seemed to later interpret this as meaning they might be civilians, but that wasn't clear from the original answer. Jason Turner has said he doesn't remember seeing the helicopters land and didn't see them. And I'm going to butcher the surname here potentially, but is it Ryan Vigilt? Originally described them as a couple of Air Force guys in plain flight suits, later saying they are plain green flight suits with no names or insignia. Doesn't say how he knew they were Air Force, but later says absolutely Air Force based on a glimpse of the uniforms he could see under the jumpsuits. With no offence intended, I've worn those jumpsuits for helo trips between ships and from ship to shore. They don't show a lot of your uniform. That's an awfully tiny detail to remember 15 years later when you say that you originally didn't find the encounter all that interesting until other people came forward. Wondering what level of certainty we have that they were definitely Air Force and not Navy or possibly even civilian government that came on board. It doesn't take that long to fly out from Coronado out to that operating area. And I would like to ask what the guys think potentially about this situation. And by the way, I served on the Connie and Ranger out of North Point and was a TAD to the Kitty Hawk a couple of times. Say hi to my fellow squids for me. That was a bit of a longer question, but PJ, you might want to come in on that one, I think.
Yeah, I know Gary's got his own part because our experiences are the same but different. You know, I understand what the gentleman is saying. You know, when they get off the helicopter, they have rubber duckies on, they have a helmet on, they have goggles on. It covers up all that stuff. Rubber ducky being a life jacket, a life preserver. By the time they made it to me, they didn't have any of that stuff off or on. They just had their flight suits. A Navy flight suit is green. An Air Force flight suit is green. But the insignia, the patches, the color of the ranks, all of that is different. And we get taught that in boot camp. You know, that's how ingrained it is in you to recognize the other service's insignia. They definitely had, at least on my end, on the Nimitz, Air Force flight suits. They were lower ranking. I don't remember the length, but they were Air Force flight suits. They had Air Force patches, Air Force insignia, all of that. And being a Navy ship, you don't exactly have Air Force officers on there all the time. They stand out. You know, that's something that you remember, that they were there. And where my shop was on the Nimitz, it's a hike to get there. You got to go up some and down some and around some corners. It's not a straight shot just to get to us. So if they're making it all the way over to where I am, it's something I remembered. Gary?
Well, our guys that came over to our ship, you know, it could be anything from, you know, I keep getting interviews where they talk about the men in black that came to my ship. And I always correct them and say, oh, you mean the men in khaki? Because they, you know, we're talking polo shirts, khakis. We'll say semi business formal, or not formal, just business casual type of attire. Unlike PJ, I actually had to sign the chain of custody, which is actually the only thing I signed about this entire event, and that's actually why I got a little confused when I first. I had to make sure that wasn't non-disclosure agreement I signed, because I up to that point I literally never signed a chain of custody in my entire life, because we'd never given anything out other than tapes to tech reps and things of that nature, which didn't require a chain of custody. We did sign. I did sign a chain of custody for our data recording tapes. So there is at least a paper trail somewhere, just not one that we can follow.
Awesome. Thank you. Guys, just a couple more questions and then we can wrap up. I appreciate the time. Kevin, this next one is for you. Did an officer give you instruction to investigate the radar anomalies?
No, as a matter of fact, after this happened, I went up to Combat Information Center, CIC, and I was going to, I didn't know how the captain was going to react, but I was going to draft an after action message because I was a primary operational message writer for the ship. And then, you know, I'd write the message and then I would route it through the chain of command and the captain would end up releasing it. Because of the way he was acting, I pulled him off to the side. Hey, Captain Smith, what's going on here? What are these objects? And he looked at me with a very perplexed look and said, I don't know, maybe ice, spontaneous forming ice from space, he said. And I have to admit, laughing out loud, and I'm glad he didn't get mad at me for it, but I actually laughed at him. Okay. So the next day I went up to combat. I was going to draft a message after action report, and I didn't know if he was going to release it or not, but I was going to try. And I went over to the, to get my data and stuff. I went over to the RD390, which recorded all of our external communications on the radios.
Which is already deleted.
And lo and behold, all of my voice comms were gone.
You're welcome.
You know, every time we key the mic on the external, it gets recorded. The date time, it gives a date time stamp and then the follow on voice comms. Well, strangely enough, all the date time stamps were on the disk still, but all the comms were gone.
Yep.
And I looked at the technician and I could tell that he knew what had happened. And I'm not going to mention his name because he hasn't come out yet. But I just gathered instinctively that he knew, but he couldn't tell me. And I respect that. And I gave up the idea of writing a message at that point. Because I had figured out that something very strange had happened. And it was way beyond my pay grade to figure it out. So I just left it alone.
Because what Kevin didn't know is while he was doing all that with the captain and trying to figure out how to report this, I was turning over data tapes and being instructed to erase everything.
Yeah, I figured all that out later. Yeah.
And, you know, and ironically, I didn't know that he was the one that accessed the data afterwards until we told our story separately later on. And I was thinking, it's like we were literally in the same room the first time I heard it. We were on stage over in Laughlin. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm the asshole that erased that on him.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
Yeah. So,
yeah, it was truly a head scratcher. And, you know, there was only one guy in the ship that had more sea time than me, was the captain. I had 18 years of sea time on Ticonderoga class ships that day when that happened. And I had never experienced anything like this. You know, usually when we do exercises and operations, everything's been scripted months in advance and practiced and rehearsed and repracticed and debriefed and briefed and debriefed. This thing was so far outside of the realm of anything I'd ever seen. I didn't know what to do, so I didn't do anything.
And Kevin, the next question again is for you. Was it yourself who guided Chad Underwood during the filming of the FLIR video, or was it a colleague?
Restate the question. It was a little bit broken.
Was it yourself that guided Chad Underwood during the filming of the FLIR video, or was it a colleague of yours?
That FLIR video that we see on the internet is from Chad Underwood's flight. Is that what you're asking?
That's not quite what they're asking. What they're asking is whether you guided him in exactly to where the object was to film it. He would have guided him to the area, like the general area where it was, and then Chad would have done his own interrogation from that point on.
Yeah, and you have to remember we got data links too, so he can look at his systems in the aircraft and see where he's supposed to go as well from the data links.
Cool. Next question to the floor. If the Tic Tac was sending or receiving electromagnetic signals, could Hawkeye discern directionally where the origin of the data was coming from?
Yes.
Oh, sure. There you go. Yes. Yes, yeah. It can. 100% yes. And actually, if it was squawking anything just about if it was, depending on what frequency it was, a lot of the ships could have seen it in Hawkeye specifically, because, well, that's literally what it's there for.
And Andy, just so you know, when during operations on the ship, like the radar operator will say, new track 4425, and then everybody in a position on the air side is going to chime in with their own piece of information. And one of those guys is the electronic warfare supervisor. And he is specifically looking for that. He's looking for signals coming from that contact, because with his information, I'm able to tell, hey, this is a comm air because it's got comm air radar. Or, hey, this is a Soviet MiG-25 because it's got that type of signature. So I use all of these little pieces of information to make the identification.
And that's where the problem we
found. In this case,
is there, we couldn't find figure out what it was.
There was no electronic emissions from these things.
Because I mean, everybody wants to look at this stuff and say, okay, well, there could have been, a person that made a mistake. Well, it doesn't matter if a person made a mistake, the entire battle group didn't make a mistake. And there's so much information that we're using to try to figure out exactly what these objects are, is that it feels like anybody that's really trying to debunk it based off of that fact about us not being trained enough or somebody making a mistake, it feels like they're just trying to make a sensational accusation. Because if you knew the way that this stuff works, and that's what we're trying to relay to people, is that there's no way we made a mistake that this was an unknown object. There was no way we made a mistake that it was a solid object. There's no way that we made a mistake about how fast it went or the capabilities of it. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking to you right now. If we didn't believe it, and we wouldn't be here. And if it wasn't real, then the government definitely wouldn't have said it. They said anything at all. They would have just been like, yeah, sure, believe what you want to believe, just like they have for the last 60 years. But instead, they had their hand pulled this time. Yeah, there was hard. It's really hard to deny the video evidence that we put forward, and then from there, we can testify the rest. We've got video, we've got radar, we've got, audio, we've got the pilots themselves. I don't know how much more people want at this point. Either get on board or get the hell out of the way.
Yeah, that's fair.
Send us some money to go figure it out.
Give us enough money, I'll take you with us.
Yeah, we want help fund us, and we'll go out there and we'll figure this shit out.
If you just advertise a CE5 experience for $2,500, you'll get a few people jumping on board, I'm sure, as well. So
I can flog them or waterboard them or something, and they can hallucinate it if they want.
I think there's places you can go for that kind of stuff anyway. So two more questions. Do you guys know of others, and I'm sure you will, and can you give an estimate of what sort of numbers of people have had similar experiences to yourselves that just haven't came public yet, and any details at all you can share?
Well, to give you an idea, since I went public with this, I've probably had just personally over at least 100 different people of credible nature, whether they're pilots, prior military, with top secret clearances. Mostly, I'll be honest with you, mostly pilots, commercial pilots and military pilots. I've gotten over 100 emails depicting various from back in the, back in the 50s and 60s, I've got some guys that won't come public about it, but definitely wanted me to know the story and that I'm not alone, in that kind of situation. And I know that the other guys have all received emails from people, and of course I take everything with a grain of salt until I kind of look into things. And I'm appreciative of any of the stories that anybody wants to share with us. But I think, without a shadow of a doubt, there's not a day that doesn't go by that a new witness is not created. So I'm thinking every single day a pilot sees something, a credible witness sees something that they can't explain running through the skies. I think it's that common, and I think that's why it permeates our society so thoroughly.
Well said, Gary. I agree with all that.
Awesome. Next question. I had a few people ask this one. I know it's something that we talked about just before the show as well. Have you got any comments on Deep Prasad and his time with UAPX?
Well, good kid. You should get off of Twitter so much. And we don't have anything other really to say about him. That's there's not much to say about him. You know, he was with us for a while. We hadn't really done anything yet before we separated. He didn't particularly like how we monitored his social media, so he left the company. And that's our official statement as UAPX.
Nope. Yeah, the whole reason why all this started is actually goes back to him in an article that Tim McMillan wrote. They called the group, what was it, the Silicon Valley UFO Hunters, right, Gary?
Yeah.
And that's when I was the first one to reach out to Deep, say, hey, Deep, this is me, and I'm the guy that you need to talk to. And that's how he kind of came to join us. And it's unfortunate.
Like I said, that's all we're going to talk about him. We had our official statement, and that's it.
Yeah, I know that.
Exactly right.
And thank you for making the statement as well. I appreciate you answering that. Last question, and I'm looking for an answer here from all of you. With the UAP task force now being formed and underway, are we going to find out within the next, I'll give an estimate here, 2 to 3 years, that these unidentified craft have an origin that is not of this earth, if I word it that way?
I know.
Sorry, I missed a dog working.
Basically, they want to know if hopefully here soon we'll find out whether these are aliens or not. I know Kevin hopes they are. I'm scared no matter which way it goes. I'll be dead honest. All of this shit it scares the hell out of me because I don't see a good direction that this is going into. And if I'm completely wrong and it actually goes in the direction where they're just these people that have lived here and they're just helping us, I will gladly eat crow.
PJ, do you want to come in on that?
I don't know if they're going to get anywhere anytime soon. They've got a lot of work to do just to catch up to where everything is.
And Kevin,
man, this universe of ours is so freaking huge. The odds that we are the only living, you know, when I say we, I'm including every, like even like mosquitoes and stuff, you know, like every living organism on our planet, the chances that we are the only living organism in the entire universe has to be zil. It has to be zero. In fact, the opposite has to be true. Now, that's not to say that they even care about us or they're the ones visiting us or that's what we saw. But I honestly don't believe that we're alone in this universe. In my mind, is scientifically impossible. It just is. There's no freaking way that's going to prove true.
That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to take care of yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.